Ms. Pepin Furstenfeld. Once again, this is Furstenfeld versus Pepin Furstenfeld. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Matt Catlett. I represent the appellant in this case, Justin Furstenfeld. Furstenfeld versus Pepin matter is what I call a case and a half. I have the district court case number permanently imprinted on my brain, CI09478. This is not the first time that a matter between these two parties has been before the appellate courts of Nebraska. In December 2010, the parties are divorced in Lancaster County. About 8 months later, the appellee Lisa complains to modify, alleging a change in circumstances justifying a reduction or suspension in my client Justin's parenting time and an increase in child support. Justin files an answer denying the allegations and counter-complaining or claiming for a change in custody. Trial is set to occur in December 2011. Just prior to trial, Justin dismisses his counterclaim. Trial does not occur. It is continued at Lisa's request until March of 2012. The court then on its own continued the matter until May. A lot of this stuff is not explicitly in the record. These are kind of chambers hearings that there's this court reporter. It's kind of background. Trial does not occur in May 2012. June 18, 2012, Lisa files a motion with the court asking the court to enforce a, quote, oral agreement that she contended, alleged therein, that she and Justin reached on May 21st, 2012. She did not allege what the terms of this agreement were, of course. A chambers hearing is held in July on this motion, and the court essentially doesn't enter an order. As I recall it, I was there. I think the court said something like, we'll take it up at trial. Again, not in the record, I admit that. The district court at that time simply just reset trial on the Lisa's complaint to modify. Throughout the summer and fall of 2012, Lisa engages in discovery and some motions. One motion was to order Justin to sign a document instructing certain non-parties to produce records that they had in their possession to me. Justin appeals that. The Nebraska Supreme Court sort of puts everything on hold. Nebraska Supreme Court in December of 2013 issues an order saying not an appealable order, not final. So it comes back down. In the meantime, there had been various contempt actions filed, two by Justin, two, I think, by Lisa. One of Justin's contempt actions was initiated in 2011, and I think one of Lisa's was also initiated in 2011, and then Justin had another one that was filed, I think, in the summer of 2013. In any event, a hearing is held in October of 2013. This is while the case is still on appeal to the Supreme Court from this order to sign this.
Let's go back to May 16, 2012.
Yeah.
There's supposed to be a deposition taken that day. You arrive at Mr. Poppy's office. Negotiations take place. And it appears that a settlement agreement was reached between you and Mr. Poppy that day. Is that correct or not?
No. That's not correct. There was undeniably a deposition that was scheduled that day. There was discussions. There was some discussions about a potential agreement. And at the end of that discussion, we simply called Judge Colburn and said, you know, we think we have this case resolved. Please go ahead and take it off the trial calendar. He said, fine. He said, we think we'll have something in writing signed by the parties soon. So I don't think it's a fair characterization at all to say that there was an agreement. I think that there was I guess, a plan, you know, so to speak. There well, just trial, wasn't a reason to have a trial.
Trial was scheduled within the next 5 days.
Right, right.
Right? So you had a trial pending, a deposition scheduled 5 days before trial, mm-hmm. and instead of having the deposition taken, you negotiate, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's how it actually turned out. I don't think Mr. Poppe even had a court reporter present that day at the office, but...
And then that same day, did you and Mr. Poppe get on the phone to call the judge together to say we don't need a trial anymore?
No. What we said was we think we have... I remember it. I was there. I said...
Were you on the call to the judge?
Was I on the call?
Yes.
Yes, yeah. We initiated the call from a little phone in
one of Mr. Poppe's
conference rooms. And we called the judge. I mean, we weren't on the record. I think we just called him. And... we said, we think we have it settled. Let's go ahead and take this trial off the calendar. You know, if hell breaks loose, whatever, we can just come back and get a new trial, which had happened before.
That last comment you just made, was that testified to you during the trial?
Well, now this is, so to get into the merits of the issue here, and my arguments, part of the reason that I wanted to get into this kind of history here is that it's all relevant. I mean, we contend that basically what happened is that in July of 2012, when the court doesn't do anything, you know, and then Lisa proceeds to file motions and, you know, take Justin's deposition in September, and then file all these discovery-related motions, motion for Christmas parenting time, whatnot. I mean, these motions essentially convey an impression to Justin that there is no settlement. I mean,
this
you can
is
take
your,
alternative
excuse
positions.
Me, Mr. Catlett, is this your... equitable estoppel
this
argument.
This is my estoppel.
And that was not raised to the district court.
Yeah, I don't understand this because this is a motion. This isn't a complaint. I mean, with a complaint, you get an opportunity to file an answer. You get an opportunity to file a motion under 12B to dismiss for failure to state a claim.
But during the trial on the motion to enforce, you don't raise the equitable estoppel argument.
There's no way to raise it. This is what I contend. The real problem, of course, is that there is no statute that specifically authorizes a motion to enforce. I mean, it's been sort of implicitly recognized by the Supreme Court in a
couple
of cases.
It's a contractual cause of action.
I'm sorry?
Yeah. A contractual cause of action.
I mean, it's a, you know, I think there was one case, I can't remember the name of it right now, but essentially the lawyer argued on appeal that what it should be treated as like a motion for summary, you know, a motion for summary judgment, the appropriate way to do this is to amend, seek leave to amend the complaint, add a cause of action in that complaint for, you know, the existence of some agreement that would resolve the dispute. But, you know, whatever. I mean, the bottom line is that the words equitable estoppel did not come out of my mouth at the hearing on April 7, 2014, or there is no denying or disputing that. However, I just don't think that you get, I don't think that you get to take contrary positions in the same case. I think you can take alternative positions, but not a contrary position.
What authority would you cite us for that one?
That you can take contrary, well, I think that a person can assert alternative causes of action, that if the facts say don't support this one, but they support, you know, another.
And you do that in a pleading, right?
Yeah, you would do that in a plea.
Okay, so what does that have to do with what happened here?
Well, again, she's alleging that there was an oral agreement. First of all, that is another problem, is that what are the terms of this oral agreement? What exactly is it?
Weren't the terms sent to you that same day? Wasn't there an agreement put together by Mr. Poppe's office that was emailed to you, and your response to it was, I believe this accurately reflects the agreement?
I believe this accurately reflects the agreement? Yeah, that's an exhibit that should never have been received by the court.
You didn't object to that one.
Huh?
You didn't object to your email, though.
To
your email response, you didn't object to the receipt of that exhibit.
No, that's because I was on the witness stand
right at
the time it was offered, which is another problem in this case.
You think that was an ethical problem for you?
Do I think it was an ethical problem?
Yes.
Well, first of all, there was a pretty good argument that myself and Justin shouldn't have even shown up to the hearing. I mean, it wasn't a trial. There was no subpoenas issued. I didn't have any idea specifically what opposing counsel was going to do. The bottom line is that the law is absolutely clear that you cannot call opposing counsel as a witness in any case unless you first prove that the testimony is material and unobtainable elsewhere. How is it material for Mr. Poppy to have called me as a witness to prove an oral agreement between Justin and Lisa on May 21st, 2012? And that's what the motion alleged. That's what it alleged. It didn't say an agreement between me and Mr. Poppy. It didn't say a written agreement. It didn't say any of that stuff.
It said you had represented to Mr. Poppy that you had an agreement, which implied that you had your client's permission to indicate to Mr. Poppy and the court that this case was settled. Did it not?
I guess I'm not understanding the question.
The exchange that you had with Mr. Poppy, including the email that you now claim shouldn't have been in, indicated that an agreement had been reached between the clients.
I think the email said something like, this appears to be what we discussed, I think.
It said, I believe this accurately reflects the agreement.
No, it's a belief. Again, I think also the rest of that email says, I will need to forward this to my client.
And get his signature.
That's correct, okay? So this relates to this statute 7-107. I see I'm out of time. And so I'll take any other questions, otherwise I'm out of time.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
May I please the court? My name is Andrew Joyce, and I'm appearing on behalf of Morrow Poppy Law Firm, Ripon. We represent the appellee in this matter. With the court's permission, as a preliminary matter, I'd just like to address one procedural issue before I address some of the substantive issues in this matter. Specifically, there are a number of things. I think the court touched on it during the appellant's oral argument, but there are a number of issues and arguments and theories that were raised in the appellant's brief that were not ever argued, litigated, discussed at the lower court level. And specifically, the equitable estoppel theory that Ms. Pepin withdrew her motion by continuing to file other issues in this matter. The second one is that I believe there was an argument that there was a Scrivener's error on the motion that essentially that the court is precluded from enforcing the order because I believe the motion said May 21st, 2012 instead of May 16th, 2012 is in terms of the date settlement agreement took place. The third was that there is no significance to agreements purporting to establish child support. And the last one was that courts cannot hear oral evidence at evidentiary hearings. None of these issues were raised at the appellate level, at the district court level. And so I think it is improper to raise those now at the appellate level. So with the court's permission, the focus of this oral argument will relate to the three issues that were actually argued at the lower court level and that were raised on appeal. And these issues are, number one, whether Mr. Catlett had the authority to bind his client on the settlement agreement. Number two, whether the district court properly allowed Mr. Catlett to testify as a witness. And then number three, whether the district court properly admitted certain evidentiary exhibits. And with respect to the first matter, whether he had authority to bind, the standard that the Nebraska Supreme Court observed in Luthke versus Sewer says that in order to enforce an oral settlement agreement between attorneys, there need to be three factors that are present. The first is that there needs to be an offer and unconditional acceptance, leaving no material terms unsettled. The second is that the local rules, the statutes, and the statute of fraud don't require the settlement to be in writing. And then the third one, and I would just suggest that the third one is really the only matter that's at issue in this appeal, is that the attorneys had the express authority to bind the clients, or if the attorney was without the express authority, the clients were present and did not object to the terms when they were stated. And so with respect to that third factor, the standard set forth in Luthke says that the power of an attorney to act for his client in an action is considered valid and sufficient until disproved. And secondly, that the disputes over an attorney's authority to settle these matters are factual issues for the court, and these factual findings will not be disturbed unless they're clearly erroneous. So essentially, the burden is on the appellant to prove that that the court's finding that he either had authority or that the client was present when these terms were the settlement agreement were entered into. They need to essentially prove that they were clearly erroneous.
And there was evidence in this case, wasn't there, that the district court could consider with regard to the client being on the phone with Mr. Catlett during the deposition slash negotiation day?
Excuse that again?
During the day that was scheduled for depositions but ended up being negotiations.
Sure.
That he was on the phone with him that day.
Exactly. And so essentially how this worked was, as Mr. Catlett stated, it was going to be a telephonic deposition of Mr. Furstenfeld. And as I understand it, he was away at a rehab facility, as the record indicates. And so this was taking place telephonically. And so once it sort of evolved into a settlement discussion, essentially the attorneys met in the conference room, and then they would continuously, or they would periodically go and meet with their clients regarding the terms. Mr. Poppy would meet in a separate conference room with Ms. Pepin, and Mr. Catlett would meet with Mr. Furstenfeld telephonically. So Mr. Furstenfeld was apprised of the details of the settlement conference throughout the settlement negotiation. And there's one piece of evidence I think is particularly relevant in terms of establishing Mr. Catlett's authority to bind Mr. Furstenfeld in with the settlement agreement. And it's shown by Exhibit 65, referring to Justin. Mr. Catlett, the day before the settlement agreement, he sends Mr. Poppy an email. And this email states, here's what he, referring to Justin or Mr. Furstenfeld, here's what he's authorized me to offer. And then sets forth a pretty detailed and extensive settlement offer. And then at the end of that email, he says, this is a serious offer, and your client should carefully consider this. Okay, so I think that at least starts to give credence to the fact that he did have to at least enter into these discussions and talk to him. And I think with the addition to the fact that he was, that Mr. Catlett was in communications with Mr. Furstenfeld, I think that distinguishes this case from some of the other cases regarding oral settlements that Nebraska's Supreme Court has presided over. Specifically, there's some cases, I think Luthke was one of them, where you know, the attorneys are meeting, and then after they've reached an agreement, then they have the discussions with their clients, and that really wasn't the case here. Both of the parties in this matter were fully apprised of the details of this settlement agreement throughout the process. It was an active negotiation, and at the end of the agreement, after everything's been settled and they've called the court to tell them that there has been an agreement that's been reached, Mr. Poppy's assistant, Cindy Paul, sends Mr. Catlett an email, and this contains a stipulation of all the terms that were set forth in the agreement. And in response to this email, Mr. Catlett says, quote, I believe this accurately reflects the agreement. And so there was never any dispute in terms of the material provisions of the agreement. There was never really, in terms of anybody's mind, the fact that there was never a dispute that an agreement had been reached. Now, whether subsequently to this, Mr. Furstenfeld perhaps got cold feet on the agreement, who knows? I don't know that, and that's not on the record, but what I do know is that there was a lot leading up to the fact, or up to the negotiation, that establishes that he did have authority to bind. And specifically, I think it's pretty telling if you refer to page 34 of the Bill of Exceptions. Before closing the hearing on the April 7th matter, the judge asked Mr. Catlett, he said, quote, what evidence do I have that he did not authorize you to enter into this agreement on May 16th, 2012? And Mr. Catlett doesn't offer a response to this matter. And I think that's particularly telling because keep in mind that it is the appellant's burden to prove that an agreement wasn't made and that the factual finding by the court was clearly erroneous. And so I think this particular provision is telling. I think the court is trying to basically assert if there's any evidence that we have that really would show that there's not an agreement, please present this. And the court was never given an any evidence that would show that an agreement wasn't reached.
When the call was made to Judge Colburn on the afternoon of the 16th, was there any equivocation as to whether or not the settlement had been reached and the trial could be called off?
Not that's reflected in the record, and not that was reflected in the court's recollection of the matter. It was, as far as the record could tell, it seemed that it was pretty well settled that an agreement had been made. And I take a bit of issue with the fact that the appellant had stated that it was uncertain. They said that they believed that there was an agreement made, but we're going to work out the details. I don't believe that was, number one, what the record reflects was the situation. And truthfully, if there were still matters to be ironed out, as it were, then there would have been no reason that the parties would have told the court to take it off of their docket. It just, as a matter of practice, it just wouldn't have been done. As far as the court was concerned, as far as the parties were concerned at that time, the agreement had been reached.
And if I understand the testimony at the trial on the motion to enforce, Mr. Catlett could not say that the proposed stipulation that was offered into evidence was not the agreement that was reached.
That's correct. Mr. Catlett was asked about the stipulation, and he said that he had, quote, no reason to believe that the attached stipulation was not included in the email from Ms. Mm-hmm. Paul, Mr. Poppy's secretary, to Mr. Catlett. So he said he had no reason to believe that it was not attached, and so that further illustrates that these were the terms of the settlement agreement. They're very well fleshed out, and I believe that the record shows and the transcript shows that an agreement was reached in this matter, and that we would just ask that the court enforce the agreement.
It really comes down to whether or not Mr. Catlett had the authority.
That's correct, and there's also an exception, if I may.
Yes.
There's also an exception that if the client was present when the terms were discussed and did not object, then even if he had exceeded his authority at that point, the court could still enforce the agreement. And so we would submit that while he was not physically present, because Mr. Furstenfeld played an active role in the settlement process, that we believe that this should be sufficient to meet that standard.
Thank you. How long did we take Mr. Joyce over? 43 seconds, Mr. Catlett. You were otherwise out of time, but we'll allow you 43 seconds of rebuttal.
Thank you. One thing I guess I didn't get to in my initial argument was the, Chapter 7-107 sub 2. This is the statute that essentially says that an attorney does have the authority to bind his or her client to an agreement. However, no such agreement, evidence of such agreement, is receivable by the court except in these three circumstances. An agreement filed with the court, an entry thereof on the records of the court. I don't know exactly what that means. I think that means showing up and reading the terms into the record, with a court reporter present. And then the other one is statement of the attorney himself. This is really the whole problem here. Statement to the attorney himself. There was no statement to the attorney himself. What there was calling me. You can't allow Mr. Poppy to call me as a witness and ask me the question and then use my testimony as the statement of the attorney myself. This was all objected to. Thank you. I'm out of time.
Yes. Thank you very much. The case is submitted. Thank you. And we are adjourned.